Hello, I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
Welcome to Emissaries of Profits, a show by Androids and Assets, the bi-weekly show where we discuss the political economy of the Federation outpost in the Bajoran sector of the Alpha Quadrant. In other words, we discuss how decisions get made, how opportunities are distributed, conflicts resolved, and who gets screwed over. Spoilers, it's usually the Bajorans. We are talking Deep Space Nine, every episode in varying levels of detail. Today, Season 4, Episode 4, Hippocratic Oath. The original air date, the 16th of October, 1995. Interestingly, this show, this episode, directed by René Auberjonois. Odo! Steven, do you have any history of, like, October 1995 history you want to give us?
Well, I think
putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, no, I did forget to write something, so thank you. I think the big thing that happens this week is the Million Man March in Washington, which we discussed previously. Observant listeners will note it's disjunct here because we definitely went ahead with indiscretion before Hippocratic Oath. It's because we were maybe potentially getting a guest, and then that fell through, so we pushed on ahead. But now we're looping back. So yes, I would say that those are kind of the big things for that. That was the big thing domestically in the US was the Million Man March, which was again a black civil rights movement, emphasizing on, you know, the reclamation of masculinity and families from harmful stereotypes. It was spearheaded by Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. I think we talked about it when we spoke with the Sci-Fi Sisters, and they had a lot of good things to say about it. Bashir and O'Brien are returning from a biosurvey on a planet in the Gamma Quadrant.
Before we even go any further, I have one question here.
Yeah. Okay.
Why are they in the Gamma Quadrant?
Yes. That's a very good question. They shouldn't be.
Weren't they told if you go through the wormhole, it's an act of war?
They absolutely were, and they routinely continue to do so.
Anyway,
again, it's that routine provocation and declaration of war. But again, they can't be stopped because of exploration. And it's not, no one can tell the Federation not to explore. And no one could possibly interpret what they're doing as a prelude to colonization. Because it's just exploring, Marshall.
We would never deposit people on the planets out here.
Yeah, despite having done that multiple times. Yeah. one of the things that this doctrine is kind of employed actually by the United States Navy in their pursuit of what they call freedom of navigation. So what the United States Navy will do is it will mostly does with China, both other countries too, but will violate sovereign waters of countries to put their warships through there. And they'll say they're doing it out of freedom of navigation. Like they have a right, like they're keeping that the space open for international shipping. They basically say, we disagree that this is your sovereign territory and we're going to enforce that militarily against you by putting our ships there. And because it's a freedom of navigation mission, that somehow in their own minds, not a violation of sovereign territory and a declaration of war. This brain worm has a long and distinguished history. Although I will say that the freedom of navigation missions, particularly the one in China, that's a very Obama era thing. Although it does have a longer history. Moving on.
I caused that digression. I'm sorry.
No. You should be. they're having the locker room talk, but it's Deep Space Nine, so it's respectful and humane. and human. O'Brien's complaining about Keiko, you know, he barely ever sees her, and when she does show up, she has all these opinions about the things he's doing to the apartment, mostly like keeping tools and projects everywhere, including the bedroom. Bashir's like, oh, O'Brien, you're so hard done by. Wow, wouldn't it be great if, you know, he affirms O'Brien and validates him a lot and basically tricks O'Brien to saying, I wish Keiko were more like. And I think he's going to say like you, because, and then he changed it to like, well, like a man, you know. Bashir's like, haha, I got you. You know, it's mildly homophobic. But their banter is derailed because they have to make a detour to investigate a warp core in trouble. They go there. The runabout crashes. plasma field in the atmosphere drains their power, I guess, and they crash. Now, they find that what they were responding to was not a ship in danger, but a maroon society. Those who don't know what a maroon society is, they are groups of people deliberately went to an inaccessible place to start up a society because they are fugitives. It's often used to describe communities created by escaped slaves in the United States. So I think this is one of those instances. But yes, so they find that it is a group of Jem'Hadar that have fled the Dominion and are seeking to free themselves from dependence on Ketracel White. Bashir feels moved by their plight of the Jem'Hadar, but O'Brien wants to escape as soon as possible. The other thing is they're 2 days early on their mission. Like, they finished the survey faster than they should have. So also, no one's expecting them back for a while, and they'll be even longer still before they start looking. So they're really worried. They're in trouble. No help is coming. Then they essentially do bridge over the River Kwai. Bashir is zealously embracing, what he thinks is a cool and interesting puzzle, and O'Brien fears their behavior borders upon disloyalty. O'Brien ultimately sabotages Bashir and just makes the escape attempt anyway, forcing Bashir to go along. They leave the Jem'Hadar. They don't kill to die, and they have to now deal with the fact that O'Brien stabbed Bashir in the back, and that I guess O'Brien perceives that Bashir betrayed the Federation. I'm interested to know what that debrief is going to be like. I believe at the end also, Julian does threaten him with court-martial. I'm going to try to get you court-martialed for this. And O'Brien's fine, whatever. We're alive. So that's the A-plot. It touches on an interesting problem, and if anyone is knows military medicine well, what is the thing here? Because, the show is called Hippocratic Oath, right? Which is based on the ancient Greek physician Hippocrates, right? And it's still, in some sense, deployed in a lot of jurisdictions where doctors have to swear a version of it. The grab line from the Hippocratic Oath is do no harm. On the one hand, a beautiful, but also a very confusing sentiment. You certainly see how, from Bashir's perspective, he feels the ethical imperative to do no harm and to help the suffering Jem'Hadar. But he also has a military imperative to kind of make sure they die, which puts him in an awkward position. This has got to be something that has been addressed. I imagine there's things in the Geneva Convention about enemy combatants. I think you do have some obligation to provide ministrations to enemy combatants who are surrendered to you. I don't know. It's an interesting question I have. But I imagine, I think the one thing I will say, though, is just from a real politic objective situation, Bashir's dumb. Because the Jem'Hadar will kill them, right? Once he figures it out, they will just execute them and move on. Right? There's no situation where Bashir and O'Brien walk out of that situation alive, shy of escaping.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Yeah? You don't think? Because think about it from the Jem'Hadar's perspective.
Let them go. Granagar escorted them to their shuttle, which was now functional, and said, get out of here.
Yeah, only after everything fell apart.
Yeah, and I think if it had been successful, he would have done the same thing. He brought Jem'Hadar there to rid them of their addiction and to help overthrow their Vorta masters.
Yeah, yeah, he has.
If there's a way to spread that information, the Federation will do it, and that helps achieve his goals. I think Garanagar would absolutely be like, get out of here. Get this information to as many people as you can and save the Jem'Hadar. We shouldn't be slaves.
Aranagar was the head of the Jem'Hadar soldiers.
Yeah, he was the first.
Yeah. Because they live in groups of 10 and are ranked. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is also very frustrating because it contradicts an earlier statement when they had the young Jem'Hadar, and they were very clear, they don't need to eat. They just need the Ketracel White. But then the show, they talk very explicitly about the Jem'Hadar eating. It's frustrating.
I think they regretted that original episode with the child Jem'Hadar and tried to walk a lot of it back. Because that first episode of the child Jem'Hadar is pretty racist. Right. They only need drugs and violence. And it's in their very base nature to have both of those and nothing else. Is a pretty terrible.
Well, I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, it is interesting that they always stylize. They always approach this from the position of addiction. And I think it's very, to me, I think that's a far more prejudiced view. Like, you and I would never talk about our addiction to water or our addiction to food.
No.
I will free myself from my need for food. Right? I mean, I think there's probably people who have done that, but we would classify that as an eating disorder. Prejudice it brings about drugs is the one it itself promotes, right? In the sense that a drug could never be a need. Right. But if it's your biology, if that's basically what you eat and need to live, it's not really an addiction then, right?
No, for sure. I mean, I have to take a hormone every day to continue functioning normally.
Yeah.
Just in my own self. And I mean, it would be nice if my body would produce that, but it doesn't.
You fucking junkie.
But I'm not upset by that. You know, like, it sucks, but it's not the worst thing. I guess if somebody has diabetes and they live in a country that doesn't have socialized healthcare.
If you need something and you can't get it, you are vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
And that's true of anything. Like, sometimes where that thing is particularly opiates, right?
Yeah. Classifying it as an addiction is wrong, but classifying it as like a necessary intervention for healthy living would be acceptable.
I mean, there is this thing where the Jem'Hadar are engineered to need this. I think the thing with Garanagar is that he's a mutant. So he just, the machine stitching his DNA missed a stitch. And very scientific over here. And he just doesn't need the Ketracel White.
He produces it on his own. And that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So he just has that realization that he's just a mutant. Da-da-na-na-na-na-na.
No, absolutely. But that's why I think, like, if you liken this more to like insulin, it makes more sense, right? Because a lot of people in the United States, you hear horror stories about like rationing insulin and staying with a job that they hate because it provides them healthcare so they can get their insulin. And if they ever leave that job, it probably means they'll die.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're like, well, how is that not like an indentured servitude?
I think when you dig into the resistance to socialized medicine in the United States, no one will say that, but that is a lot of it. Like, well, if employers can't hold people's healthcare hostage, they'll lose a significant amount of bargaining power, Marshall. Are you going to let employers, are you going to take away the employer's ability to kill insubordinate employees? You're just going to take that away from them?
Yes. Yes, I will.
You commune.
But that's the position the Jem'Hadar are in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, yeah, it's interesting. It's just also the Jem'Hadar remain naively paternalistic in the sense it's like, oh, no, the Vorta are the problem. The Vorta are not, like, if the founders knew and understood how the Vorta were treating us, they would intercede on our behalf. We just need to, we need to break free of the Vorta to better serve the founders. We in our society need to be careful of being smug about, because I guarantee you we definitely believe the same things, but more generally about like broad concepts like democracy or freedom. Like, if we just
capitalism.
Had those, like, sure, the president is a bad person, but if we just had like if we just had a better election or something, right? Like,
yeah, Joe Manchin is the problem.
Yeah, yeah. If we just got rid of that bad egg in Congress,
the Democratic establishment hates us.
Yeah,
it's that Joe Manchin is that one holdout preventing them from carrying out their agenda.
Yeah, yeah. The Democratic Party is good. It is good and it will make life better, but it's being stopped by some bad lieutenants. And we just need to get rid of those people that stand in the way of, yeah.
Members of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, members of the Democratic Party are, turns out, the biggest. And that's true for, you know, any kind of any party. Like, I think it's very.
Yes. Very I know. But just like when you say the Democratic Party is good, except for some members of the Democratic Party. You're like, so wait, what? Well, go back a step here.
Yeah.
You know, or the Liberal Party. That logic doesn't hold.
Anyway, it does not.
I'm preaching to the converted here.
Well, yeah, I think it's true. But I mean, we in our societies in Canada, the US, if we heard someone talking about like, oh, the king's vizier is the problem. If the king only knew what the nobility were doing to us, he would act. And we would be like, pshaw. That's so naive. What a bunch of dum-dums. Well, you believe the same thing. You do. Unless you were jaded. there's a good chance you as a North American person believe the same thing. It's just,
yes.
You have like, it's just, there's a few extra layers to it. But I do want to say, I think this is like my broad theory about addiction and substance abuse. The way that the war on drugs was articulated was this belief that the heroin, the opiate molecule inside heroin is a bad molecule, right? It's a bad molecule and it wants to destroy you. And if you let it into your body, it will hijack you and make you do prostitution and violence. And I don't think that's true, right? That is true. If this is so toxic and dangerous biologically and morally, that mere exposure to it would destroy your life, we'd have a lot of problems because there's tons of opiates floating around. There's lots of exposure. You know, it's much more contextual, right? Which is why the drug war doesn't work, right? Because it's not just the problem is not exposure. It's exposure and context. But the contextual saliences are much more important than the molecule itself.
Well, and interestingly, that molecule impacts wealthy people differently than it impacts poor people.
Yes, absolutely. I think that we need to like rebuild in terms of our understanding of drugs. And I don't think this show gets there really with that. I think it's still very much operating in this toxicological modality where it's like, oh, yeah, Tetracel White is a drug and a toxin. And it's destroying the Jem'Hadar and keeping them in bondage. No, the entire edifice of the Dominion, from their genome to their actual to an actual then, you know, like armed enforcement apparatus, is the problem. The Tetracel White is only one link in that chain, right?
Well, and as a species, Tetracel White keeps them alive.
And if the society of the Dominion changed, the Tetracel White would cease to be a problem.
Right.
Because actually, you could probably very cheaply deliver abundant Tetracel White to all Jem'Hadar quickly and easily forever. Much more so than
easily.
You could grow food.
The portrayal of it as a drug is just wrong. It's wrong and it's problematic.
Yeah, but the problem is not with the molecule itself. Right.
No.
Like molecules are just molecules, you know. They do what they do. And thus it's much more about what meaning is brought to them and how they interact with society and discourse. And power.
The other thing about the A plot, Julian's sort of evolution as an officer. He as a doctor, I think he skipped the ensign phase.
Yeah, probably.
And just immediately became a junior lieutenant.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in sort of like military hierarchies and such, going through these particular steps is useful.
Yeah.
Like learning to be an officer and learning to have command in a more junior officer role and giving orders and like how to be authoritative.
How to actually command in the field.
Yeah, like these are important things. So when you just sort of like skip one of these phases and they're like, well, you're a doctor, so you won't actually be a field commander. You don't ever need to really have that. You're going to be in an operating room. he's trying to tell his friend, you have to listen to my commands. I'm an officer and you are not. Like, you need to listen to me.
Yeah. Or and arguably, he's
like, yeah. But like, I have way more experience than you. I've been in the field. I've fought soldiers. I know better than you.
I think that's true. I think O'Brien is right. And Bashir is really wrong. And he should listen to his NCO.
You should. I'm never going to say, like, don't listen to your chief petty officer. They've been doing this and they know what they're about. You should take their advice. But the fact is, as an officer, you outrank them and you give them orders, right? And they have to obey them. And so Julian, rightly or wrongly, says, I am going to save these Jem'Hadar. I'm going to do it because it's the right thing to do. And O'Brien, by disobeying, is like, he is insubordinate as a matter of law.
Yeah. Bashir fails to maintain discipline.
Yes. But I don't think he's ever had the opportunity to really learn how to maintain discipline. And so this is like a very fundamental development of him as an officer. Mm-hmm. Because then later you see when he's out in the field, people listen to him and he's like, no, I know what this is about. I know what to do. Don't fuck with me.
Yeah, it is interesting that this episode is largely about discipline and punishment.
Yeah,
in the sense that there is the discipline, there is the relationship of the discipline enforced on the Jem'Hadar about through the Ketracel White, the discipline of the Jem'Hadar leader on his troops, because he brings to that planet the belief he can just simply discipline them into independence. He can just take them to the planet and the planet will heal them. They just do what he does, and they follow.
Well, because he had been stranded there in the past.
Yeah.
This is his second trip to the planet. And when the Ketracel White ran out the last time he was on this planet, he was fine.
Yeah.
And then he was like, oh shit, I don't need this stuff. So he made the assumption, erroneously, that the planet provided something that allowed him to survive.
The plot is also, by and large, about discipline and punishment.
Yes, it is. It is. Am I wrong, or does Julian say to O'Brien, like, if we can't be friends anymore, then that's fine?
Yeah.
I'm a Starfleet officer, and you need to listen to me. And if our friendship makes it impossible for you to listen to me, we can stop being friends.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, something to that effect, certainly. Again, this is where I'm hoping, like, if you have military experience, like, please, particularly if you're an officer, weigh in on this. I don't think Bashir's orders are lawful. I think I do really think it is a bridge over the River Kwai situation. Like, Bashir is being far too enthusiastic. Like, because I think there is like a thing where, like, you know, the Geneva Convention and so on. Like, if you're taken captive, you like can't like you are expected to comply, but not comply too much, you know. there's like a fine line there. Like, if people tell you a gunpoint to dig a ditch, you dig a ditch. You know, you don't say I am, you know, shoot me then, because I'm not going to dig a goddamn ditch.
Julian is certainly naive and he's certainly enthusiastic. But he is a doctor first and foremost, and he is part of the Federation. And they do all sorts of wild things for their enemies.
They do. I mean, we've been over this. Sisko has been traitorous a couple of times in his helpfulness.
Several times.
Yeah, several times. Oh, right. Yeah, treasonously helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, anyway. Again, is not necessarily wrong. It's just, I think one of the things we also want to know is we're not big nationalists and we don't like really believe in like the idea of like of treason being like a great crime or anything, but it is a crime. It also exists in the world.
Yes.
These are concepts that have meaning and weight, especially in times of war, whether or not we think they're like inviolate moral imperatives or not.
Yeah. If you're saving lives, I don't really care whose side you're on.
Yeah. And you can, sometimes the right thing is the treasonous thing.
So the B plot, shall we?
Yeah.
It's a very Worf growth B plot. Worf discovers that Quark is working with a smuggler. And so he takes the info to Odo And Odo is like, thanks for the information, but this is my job. Let me do it. Fuck off. And Worf is like, okay. Like, I thought we were bros, but whatever. Doesn't listen, gets more information and takes it to Dad. And Ben is like, okay, great, thanks. But again, this is Odo's job. Let him do it. You have your own job. Just like stay in your lane.
Your job is like coordinating. Your job is like coordinating battleships for space war, not like catching people committing minor crimes.
Yeah, exactly. Or major crimes. Any crimes whatsoever, in fact. You are not in law enforcement. Worf, though, has been a security chief for far too long, and he can't let this go. He's got a bone, and he is going to pick it. He sneaks into the bar at night, and he watches Quark make his plans. He takes that angrily to Odo and says, look, you're not doing your job. And Odo, at this point, gets angry and yells at him, and Worf gets offended. So then Worf is like, fine, if you're not going to do it, I will. And he goes and he like tracks Quark while he's going to make an exchange of money for goods, and is like, ha, this is a crime and I'm witnessing it, so I'm honor bound to arrest you. and he does so without realizing that Odo was deep undercover as the bag of money being handed over to the criminals. And Odo was going to find the kingpin of the smuggling ring. But now that it's been disrupted, he'll only be able to deal with this middleman. And the kingpin is going to be able to escape scot-free. Worf has some egg on his face and he feels bad and he apologizes. And Odo graciously leaves his interference out of the report to Ben. But Worf, being a very honorable dude, goes to Ben and says, I really fucked this one up. Odo had it under control and I didn't believe him. And Ben's like, that's what I told you. You should have listened to me. But don't worry, you'll fit in here eventually. So it's fine. It's about Worf like not being a security chief anymore, and so it kind of works and whatever. And Odo is, I suppose, well within his rights to just say thanks, but fuck off. But if he just communicated a little bit and said, "Yeah, I'm aware of this, and actually, you know, I trust you. You're not going to spill the beans. You're an honorable person. Quark is working with me on this one, and I'm going to infiltrate the smuggling ring." And we're going to take down the whole system, not just this one guy. And like, we're going to do some real good here. But he doesn't tell him anything because Odo is an insecure would-be authoritarian that demands all matters of legal infractions be settled by him and only in the way that he deems fit. That's it. And Worf, it's also a would-be authoritarian who demands that the law be followed exactly to its letter with no variation whatsoever. And these two authoritative natures don't really mesh well.
Yeah. Worf just shows up and blows the whistle and says, "Miss Captain Sisko, rule breaking! Tweet!"
Yeah.
He's just like, I can't sleep at night. I know out there someone breaking rules. Ah!
and Odo is, I don't know, rules being broken, but I allowed them to be broken.
Yeah. You're all cogs in my fucking machine. Yeah. Yeah. Odo, every ounce a shapeshifter, I guess. In that sense. Yeah, so this is more, I like that you talk about like authority and power there. Yeah, it's because Worf can't stand that someone is not being disciplined, right? Like,
yeah,
Worf just can't. He just can't get over it. This is a live problem for us, I think, in where we're at with like this whole thing, because I think there's a piece to which like we have a great deal of injustice and we have a great deal of infractions. And the Venn diagram of injustices and infractions only liminally touch. Right.
Yes. Only,
that's a very small overlap between rule breaking and injustice. There's a whole lot of injustice that is considered to not be breaking rules. I get it. I've been there myself. If you're like, consider yourself a law and order type person, you're like, well, what I do, I follow the rules and go to my job and, you know, and it exists in my kind of what's normal for me. And there are people that don't, they should just fuck them. Right. And you exist in your law and order world and you have, and you're not really touched a lot by some of these big non-rule breaking injustices that you're aware of. You know, it seems weird that people are coming to be like, we need to abolish the police. We need to stop doing this. Cause you don't, especially if you're not like a victim of crime, you know, we're living in like a space where like crime in air quotes is happening. You don't really understand what that means. Right. And that a lot of these people who are picked up for, again, these people that are being punished for infractions, that are being disciplined and managed, have very sad stories, and in many ways are just like have terrible lives, right? And not that that makes it okay for them to steal or hurt people. And make no mistake, that can happen. It's also not a solution, right? Because then you take that person and you put them with a bunch of other people, and they all hurt each other. And then you dump them back out in the street and they hurt. Like it's not, if you look at it and think about it at all, it's very obvious, right? If you interface the criminal justice system and you have eyes to see, you know, it's not working, right? Yeah. You know, even if you're a police officer or a prosecutor, like, I mean, you might think that it's the best we can do. I think that's the only thing that people like, I don't know. Like I talked to a prosecutor a couple of years ago, and he was like, you know, it's not a great system, but it's the one we have, and so I do it because I think this is the best we can do, and to do it differently would be worse. That's what he believed. You know, and you know, you can't. I think that's wrong. Like, just I think objectively, that's it. I think we could improve.
Yeah, I mean, that's a failure of imagination.
But I've never met someone who was like with a heart full of conviction. We have a good system that works. Even cops and prison guards are not like, yes,
no,
we're doing great. We got him, guys.
Problem solved.
I think in general that they perceive the system as flawed and believe the prescription. Sometimes they believe the prescription is either sometimes more enforcement or whatever.
I also, a lot of it makes me think of like, the myth of like the welfare queen and welfare fraud. And when you're like, yes, these people who are entirely impoverished and are committing fraud to gain maybe a couple of extra $100 in a month so that they don't lose their house. And that needs to be punished. And you're like, okay, but like they're barely existing on the social safety net, right? Like that net has caught them, but there's a lot of holes in the net and they're about to slip through. And so they commit some mild fraud. And yeah, it's technically a crime. And we're like, we need to crack down on these people who are, you know, stealing from us. And you're like, yeah, but okay. But it was like $100. Maybe we can let it go since they don't have literally anything, and instead punish some of the people who are, you know, agreeing to take bailouts in the middle of a pandemic on the agreement of not firing workers and then firing workers and walking away with billions of dollars. And you're like, how is that not fraud? Well, technically it was within the letter of the law, so it's fine.
Yeah, and the cost of there are far more expensive frauds that no one has, that are completely vast injustices. You know, and again, and so when it comes to this issue of like, well, who are we, what injustices are we picking to deem as infractions? Right. And I think this is like then a broader thing about like what's important. I think this also boils down to then a broader political question about like discipline in society. How are you going to organize your society and how are you going to keep people in line? Because for us all to live together, We all can't all have exactly what we want all the time. Right? Like that's just, yeah, that's just living with other people. Right? You can't have, things can't always be the way you want them all the time. So how do we get people, right? And I think there's, this is like the ongoing and evolving experiment. This is like my other criticism of the Federation, that like the Federation is really down with like, well, we will terrorize people at the barrel of a gun and threaten them with incarceration until they comply. this is clearly like, this evidence is proof that that is in the realm of things that happen. Now, that said, I don't know if societies that have said everything is permissible. I can't really think of one, but I think like in general, anarchist communes have not become the dominant global governance system and are seldom able to keep themselves together, in part because they view discipline itself as antithetical to their aims. Right. And this makes it very hard for them to accomplish things. Because,
on the other hand, they also do face extreme pressure from outside of their commune.
They do.
and often violence to end their commune because its existence is a fundamental risk to the rest of society.
Yeah, absolutely. So like what's the space for coercion? And I think for myself personally, I'm like, you got to have a little bit of coercive. There has to be some coercion. I don't think you can say a priori all coercion is wrong, but that in the spectrum of coercion, there's a whole lot of things, and there's forms of coercion that are not do what I say or you will fucking die. Right? there's other tools in the toolkit, especially for us now. Right.
Yes. I'm not a parent yet, but I'm excited to try that as a,
yeah,
system.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah, you can affirm, like you could actually maybe try that. These things get really difficult in the concepts of states. Why don't we give people following the speed limit bonuses instead of traffic tickets? Like, I'm not like people propose. That's dumb. But also, like that's not necessarily. Again, it requires a much broader imagination, and I think part of it is about like how are you relating to people's basic needs? How are you relating to people's self concept? How are people interacting in the public space, right? Because I think there's, before someone gets to the point where they hit another person, you've had a lot of, like a person murders another person, let's say, right? Murders are obviously not allowed. I think a lot of the time, that doesn't come from nowhere. No one's like, so-and-so killed so-and-so. And you're like, oh, did not see that coming. Right? Like, stuff happens a lot of the time, right? And there's signs and there's opportunities for you to intervene before it becomes a literal life and death situation. And I think a lot of things, we forestall the intervention till property is destroyed or someone is injured. That's like, okay, well, now it's time for us to get off our butts and do something. And the thing we do is you go in the corner for 4 years and you go in the corner for 15 years. Well, we fixed it.
I think that's kind of what Odo is doing in this instance, right? He's looking at it and saying, okay, I know that Quark is committing a small crime, but I'm going to use that to get at the people committing a much larger crime.
Yeah, it's because
he's injurious crime.
Yeah, he's actually being practical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And then also that, like, yeah, sometimes you have to put up with a little bit with some stuff that's not ideal, right? You actually have to be compromised.
Yeah. I mean, it would be great if you could do away with anybody who ever wanted to deal with a smuggler, but that's just not a reasonable outcome.
Yeah. And again, if you abolish money, right? Why do people, most crimes are committed to advance people's financial interest. So abolishing money would go a long way to injuring criminal organizations. Right.
Yeah.
Because then all of a sudden you have to if there's just like abundance, like you're not going to steal corn because you can just get all the corn you want. Right. Right. So it's like,
whatever, man, I got all the corn I need.
Well, people are afraid of the growth of state power on the other side of that. Like if you have like a comprehensive wage and price control and provision and stuff, that's going to stifle them. And then they're going to be, tied to other types of metrics for performance. you know, like this is, everyone's really horrified about China, the Sesame score in China. Which, you know, I'm not going to say is like a great thing, but it, you know, we have credit scores here, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's a difference between the credit score and the Sesame score, other than one is a measure of your profitability and one is a, like the credit score, which is a measure of your profitability to lenders, really.
Maybe, maybe measures your profitability.
And, yeah, maybe.
It's also incredibly opaque and managed by private industry with no oversight whatsoever.
Yeah, and I guess you're consumer compliant, like whatever behaviors they want. So it's just a set of behaviors set by private companies, and the Sesame score is set by, I mean, private companies I think are part of it, but mostly by the state. And I think the Sesame score is maybe a little more transparent. I don't know exactly. But like the
as far as I understand, like a credit score doesn't take into account you paying rent.
No.
At all, right?
Yeah.
So then when you want to go and get a mortgage, they're like, well, there's no proof of you having paid a mortgage in the past. You're like, yeah, but I paid rent for a decade.
15 years.
Yeah, well, we don't track that because it is beneficial to us to not track your ability to make recurring monthly payments.
Yeah. Now, do you have a credit card?
Yeah. Like, oh, so I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Got it.
So this is the issue. There's going to be stuff, right? And I think one of the things is if we get too afraid of like state or broader, like we get afraid of bureaucratic power articulating, when you don't want a bureaucracy to form, then you abdicate to private deals and interpersonal arrangements. And, you know, so you can live in a big bureaucracy or you can live in like, again, like a small proprietorship.
Many, many small ones.
Yeah. You can have many, many small bosses or a big faceless bureaucracy, right? Give me the faceless bureaucracy over the million, over the little tiny petty private things where that person, because I tell you, the bureaucracy doesn't care. You're like, whereas if you have a system of people appointing each other over each other and setting up like private deals and things, that person could decide they don't like you and make your life hell and you can't do shit about it. I think in general, like, not that bureaucracies are perfect, but I think, you know, like those small, petty, private arrangements are so much worse.
Yeah.
Are so much worse than government regulation. And if you don't believe me, take stock of your own life. Is the DMV more coercive than the guy who owns the restaurant you work at? Or worked at, right? No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So I think about these. This is, I think, the thing about discourse of power. And you can make political and social change that doesn't lead to utopia, too, right? So you might have to make a compromise. Star Trek is very clearly a compromise. It's not a utopian society. They're still working this stuff out, too.
Wrong. It's a utopia. Everything is perfect in the Federation.
We'll need to have the debate. Communism debate, but I don't think so.
I enjoyed the episode though. It's a memorable episode.
Yeah, fun.
We have fun with it.
So if you want to find our show, you can look us up at social media at AssetDroid, or you can find us at our website, androidsandassets.ca. Thank you for your time and for listening. And next time you are at a rally for your political party, the political party you belong to, put us on.
Your friends will hate it.